Hello once again, everybody. Thank you for joining me in the Bettors Box. It's bangthebook.com's MLB betting podcast for Monday, June 3rd. I'm your host, Adam Burke. This and every edition of the Bettors Box presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB and the number 200 is that promo code. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Monday, Thursday format here with the show. As you know, today is Monday. That means we're doing the Monday mailbag segment at Skating Tripods on Twitter or Adam at bangthebook.com. If you ever have any questions for the Monday mailbag, also Adam at bangthebook.com for the notes for the Bettors Box. And I will be sending last Thursday's show notes today. I did not have my contact list with me while I was out in Vegas, so didn't get the notes out for Thursday's show. We'll get both sets of notes out there for you for today's program. So my apologies for that, but didn't have the list. Wanted to make sure I didn't leave anybody out, so I apologize for that. My MLB picks and tips piece has been updated for today. It is updated daily over at bangthebook.com. Admir Aljic covering the NBA Finals for us. Parker Michaels covering the Stanley Cup Finals for us. We'll have a golf preview for you here today. We'll have NASCAR previews throughout the week. Also this week, we'll be doing a Belmont Stakes podcast with Brian Blessing. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about the Open Championship, maybe some look-ahead odds for that. Of course, we'll probably just have a podcast for that. So may just do the Belmont here this week on Wednesday in all likelihood. So we'll give you our thoughts on the final leg there of the Triple Crown. I'll have my preview of the Belmont and also this week's Philly race. I believe that's the Belmont Oaks. It's been a rough morning, quite frankly, but we'll have some horse racing content for you over at bangthebook.com here as well. All right, so as I mentioned, it is Monday, so we'll start with the Monday mailbag, then we'll go beyond the box score, down the lines, pick for Monday night's action, and then a preview of some series here for this week. So let's go ahead and dive in. Starting off with the Monday mailbag segment, at Black Dangles on Twitter asking me here to start things off, how long does it usually take you to handicap a game? Thanks for all the info that you share. So for me, it's a multi-step process for handicapping a game. I will take a look, as I always do here on the show, at the upcoming matchups in a series. And I'll start to circle some games. I'll kind of give myself an idea of what I want to look at a little bit closer as that game starts to come together a little bit. Once you get the bullpen usage, once you figure out what's going on with the lineup, stuff like that, I'll already have those games circled. So it'll kind of give me a starting point. Then I'll look at the overnight lines. Before those games that I have circled, before all the games that are on the card, go out there and grab some prices of lines that I think are going to move. It's one of the reasons why I do this down the line segment here, to get you out in front of some of those line moves and find some of those guys that the market expects positive or negative regression from. So you can hop out there, get some prices, get out in front of the market. Then I'll do a deep dive stat study the morning of the game for the write-ups. Now, games that I'm already interested in probably take me 30 to 35 minutes to completely break down. Games that I know I'm not all that interested in, I just want to share information, probably about 20 to 25 minutes. And then games where I just don't have any interest whatsoever, I'll kind of gloss over them 5, 10 minutes. Games that I know in advance I'm probably not going to play. A lot of times these will be games with, two really bad starting pitchers and you're trying to figure out which one's going to be worse. Games with two aces and you're trying to figure out which one's going to be slightly worse than the other guy. Or, teams that I just don't have a whole lot of interest in playing. Teams I don't like playing as a big favorite. Those are games I'll kind of gloss over. So kind of depends on my interest level in the game. Also, how much I've been focusing on that game in the lead up to it. So I would say roughly 20 to 25 minutes per game on average would be what I do in terms of breaking down the card. Obviously, some games do, in fact, vary quite a bit from that. At @half_ads on Twitter says, hey, Adam, I'm using a book where if I take the first five-inning money line and the score is tied at the end of the fifth, it's not a push but a loss. Is that normal in your experience? No, it's not. Get a different sports book. I don't know why that's the case at that one, but the first five money lines should be graded as a win, a push, or a loss. So definitely go out there and try to find a different book. I do know that in some instances, like for example, over at Bet Online with AHL hockey, they have prices that are regulation only. You certainly want to make sure you're checking out the house rules for different things like that. But if you have a book where the first five inning money line is graded as a loss with a tie game, not at all what you want there. So definitely make sure you look at the house rules. And similarly, I've had some questions here about action versus listed pitchers. And you always want listed pitchers. I mentioned this on Thursday's show. That's what you handicapped. You know, this is a hard enough business without throwing more unknowns into the equation. So always make sure that your bet only has action if the two guys listed are the starting pitchers. When you select action, no matter who's pitching, not only do you get that game that you didn't handicap in some instances, but you also get that game at the adjusted price, no matter what it goes off at. So action is not something that you want to do. You always want to go with listed pitchers so your bet is in play only if those guys that you handicapped are the starters. Mark via email says, how do you interpret pitchers who show a high exit velocity but a low hard hit percentage and vice versa? So I ran through over at baseballsavant.com looking for some of the guys that sort of fit the mold of what Mark's talking about here. Chris Archer, Ulys Chacin, Matt Strom, Matt Boyd, Zach Godley, Wade Miley. These are guys that you'll either have a high average exit velocity and a low hard hit percentage or a high average exit velocity. Let me try that again. A high exit velocity and a low hard hit percentage or a low exit velocity and a high hard hit percentage. Typically speaking, and when you look at the six guys here, you can kind of see this coming together. A lot of times you will find inconsistent and or slider dependent pitchers on that list. Because good sliders will induce tons of weak contact. Flat sliders will get hit a mile. So you see Chris Archer, two-pitch pitcher. Ulys Chacin, two-pitch pitcher. Matt Strom, not a ton of depth to his arsenal. Matt Boyd, you know, primarily fastball slider guy. Zach Godley, fastball curveball guy. Wade Miley, you know, a cutter curveball kind of guy. So when you see these two-pitch pitchers, that's when you'll get guys that fall in this category. Because when they hang one of their two pitches, it gets hit a long way. So a lot of times if they're locating those sliders and curveballs and cutters, you know, then they're going to have a lot of success inducing weak contact, but they may have a high hard hit percentage because those hanging pitches of theirs do go a long way. And when you're a two-pitch pitcher, hitters can kind of guess what they're looking for, kind of hone in a little bit. So that's when you get, you know, some of these big spreads in exit velocity with that primary or that first secondary pitch that guys have. So a lot of times those guys are going to fall into that category of being two pitch pitchers where when they hang one of those two pitches, it gets hit a long way because flat sliders and flat curveballs are effectively batting practice pitches for guys at the major league level. So those are the typical guys that you're going to see in that group that have the high exit velocity, the low hard hit rate, or the low exit velocity and the high hard hit rate. Derek via email here, very interesting question with this one. Says, on a small book that I use, it lets you bet first five team totals relatively early compared to the market. Sometimes the team totals aren't 100% in line with the actual total for the first five innings. So I was wondering if this would be an exploitable angle. I know that usually team totals might be more heavily juiced, but I was curious to know if this would be profitable. So today, for example, and by today he means the game with John Lester and Corbin Martin, the Cubs-Astros game where we took the over 5 at minus 120, moved to 5.5 shortly after I posted. Then that game, of course, flew over the first 5 total anyway. But he's looking at it here, and he says it's 5.5 minus $1.05 for the first 5 total. But the Cubs are over 1.5 minus 140, Astros over 2.5 minus 120. So if you split your bet on both teams' overs, you're reducing the total number by 1.5 runs and only paying about 25 cents more juice than the current total. And you're also giving yourself the opportunity for a split or a push. Do you think this is a profitable betting angle long-term in scenarios like this? Obviously, the worry here is that, first of all, juice on team totals can be very, very high. So you have to hit a very high percentage of them. Yeah, you talk about minus 110, break-even rate 52.38%. Minus 115, the break-even rate 54.9%, or 53.9%, excuse me. Minus 120 is in the 54.5 range, on up from there. So that's a consideration here, is that if you're playing these juicier team totals, you have to hit a very high percentage of them because they do have that level of juice. The second thing is that there's a chance that if you handicap wrong or if variance comes into play, instead of going 0-1 with that 5.5 team or first five over, you go 0-2 with the team total overs. So you're looking at a higher percentage of success required to break even or make money here, especially because you're going to run into scenarios where one team total wins, the other doesn't, and all of a sudden, you know, you're eating 40 cents of juice by splitting those two sides. Now, again, obviously, it's not the same thing as losing a full unit on the minus 105, but still, this is something that you have to factor into the equation. Obviously, I can see the appeal here. You know, conceptually, the idea that you are cutting that total down from 5.5 to, you know, in essence here, 4, based on the numbers that Derek's mentioning here, yeah, obviously, there's a ton of value in that. And to me, that looks like a bad line. That looks like a bad line on the Cubs over. So maybe that was just a mistake by the sports book. I don't think you're going to find too many opportunities like this. Can there be value in it? Sure. If you've got a pitching matchup with two bad guys and you want to play both team total overs for the first five, yeah, you can do that. But again, like everything else here, this is a case-by-case basis. And I think oftentimes the case is going to be that it's not really worth having the two separate bets out there, because you will run into cases where the first five will win. One team hits, the other team doesn't. You'll run into cases where neither team hits. All of a sudden, you wind up losing two bets. So as Derek mentioned, you know, maybe cutting your bet, splitting that bet that you would put on the full first five. Yeah, you could do that. I think that this is kind of overcomplicating the process a little bit here as I'm talking through it. But again, you know, if you're in a situation where the first five total is 5.5, the two team totals add up to, you know, 4 with reasonable juice, then yeah, there's probably some sort of equity in playing both of those there. I think that's definitely a possibility, but I think that's going to be few and far between, and that was probably a line error. You know, maybe Derek, if you want to reach out, respond to the email here, let me know, you know, how often you see a situation like that. That's going to kind of dictate my thoughts here on this whole scenario. But, you know, I mean, again, you want to look for every opportunity that's out there, you know, whether it is a first five team total, first five run line, something like that. Try to find these opportunities, because those different types of derivative bets, at least in theory, should be a less efficient market than betting the full games. So anytime you can try and find value anywhere you look, you certainly want to do that. One more question here. Jim via email says, I know that a significantly higher FIP and XFIP compared to ERA is often a sign that negative regression is coming, but the analysis doesn't end there, right? What stats do you look at to confirm or reject your initial presumption? A lot of things. You know, a lot of times the ERA will be lower than the FIP and XFIP because of a high left on base percentage, or will be higher because of a low left on base percentage. So batting average on balls in play, left on base percentage, two key statistics I look at to try and explain if that's the reason why there's a big gap between the ERA, the FIP, and the XFIP. Certainly, you can look at batted ball data, exit velocities against, stuff like that. Expected batting average, expected slugging percentage, expected WOBA, compared to actual batting average, slugging percentage, and WOBA over at Baseball Savant. Level of competition. You know, a lot of times I look at the game logs. I look to see if, you know, maybe you've got a high ERA because the guy's had a couple of bad starts, like really bad starts, like 8 runs in an inning and a third, something like that. You know, that's going to suggest to me that, you know, this is a guy that's probably going to get better. If it's a guy that's, you know, got a high ERA and he's giving up 3-4 runs a game, but he's doing so in 5 innings, that's another thing. So I look at a lot of game logs and look to see, you know, what explains the total number there with the ERA, the FIP, and the XFIP. You know, was it a bad start? Was it a guy who has a high home run rate because he gave up, you know, 7 home runs in his first 3 starts? He's only given up 2 home runs in his last 8 starts. Well, his FIP is probably going to come down as a result of that because he's doing a better job of keeping the ball in the park. So I look at game logs quite a bit. That's one of the handicapping things that I definitely factor in the equation. Just about every game I handicap is looking at the game logs, getting a better picture on a game-by-game basis as opposed to the larger sample size. Again, this is a sample size type of sport, so I'm not saying I discredit that, but I just want to see what the path has been to get to those full season numbers, because we are still a little bit at the point here where, you know, one or two bad starts can have a significant impact on ERA. As we get deeper into the season, that won't be the case as we get a larger number of innings for these guys. But you know, game logs are important. Plus, you can see the level of competition when it comes to game logs. Is this a guy that has gotten fat and happy against really bad teams? You know, similarly, Griffin Canning, for example, who I'll talk about later in the show, you know, he's faced a lot of bad lineups. So he's a regression candidate to me, even though the stats maybe don't suggest it, but just because he hasn't faced a lot of good lineups here, and he'll get a good lineup here tomorrow against the Oakland A's. So park factor, platoon splits, all types of things. A lot of stuff goes into the equation. That's why the write-ups are so detailed over at bangthebook.com. And Jim, if you don't already, I encourage you to check those out. All right, let's go beyond the box score here and recap some series and some things that happened over the weekend. We start with the Twins and Rays as the Twins take 3 out of 4 from Tampa Bay. Best record in baseball now for Minnesota at 40-18. Lots of slugging percentage all over the lineup. Doubles, home runs, that's how you score in today's run environment. They're third in doubles with 127, first in homers with 109. Over the last 30 days, their slugging percentage is 30 points better than anybody else in baseball. Second highest fly ball percentage, Seattle has the highest. The Twins have the right offensive blueprint here. And in fact, they get Nelson Cruz back here today as well. So, you know, just another hitter coming into the lineup for them. But that's what they're doing. They're hitting a lot of doubles and a lot of home runs. And that's very important here in the current landscape of Major League Baseball because it's harder and harder to manufacture innings against all this velocity, against increased scouting reports on the defensive side, more efficient scouting reports. The Twins are doing it the right way offensively. And it's a sustainable offensive model. And that's a big difference between the two teams here that just played the Twins and Rays because for the Rays, a lot of opposite field contact, a lot of ground balls, a BABIP-dependent offense, and you can get into spells where you just don't score a lot of runs with that type of offensive setup. The Twins, I think, are largely immune to offensive slumps because they are able to score with high slugging percentage outcomes. So I think the Twins are really set up for success the rest of the way. Jake Odorizzi was great. Kyle Gibson was good enough. Martin Perez did get knocked around. We'll see how he performs in his next start. But a lot of organizational wins in this rotation for the Twins. The lineup looks good. They're here to stay. It's that simple. I undersold them coming into the year. Rocco Baldelli is doing a great job. This is their division to lose. And I think that right now, the way that things are setting up, they could very well wind up running away with it. But here's what I'm talking about with Tampa Bay here. They had 7 extra base hits in the first game of this series, blew out the Twins 14-3. They had 5 extra base hits in the last 3 games of this series combined. And that's the hard part for Tampa Bay. That's what worries me about their sustainability in the American League East. They probably wind up at least being a wild card team, but that's a concern for me offensively for them is that it's harder for them to score runs. They make a lot of high velocity contact. But it's harder for them to score runs because of the number of hits they have to string together to do so. The Twins don't have that problem. Other teams around the league don't have that problem. The Rays have that problem. I was worried about it coming into the season. I'm still worried about it now. The pitching is still very good for Tampa Bay. But that offensive blueprint is just not something I can sign off on. And again, it's worked for them now for about 1.5 years. So we'll see if they can keep it going. But it's a tough sell for me. The Brewers took 3 out of 4 from the Pirates here. The Brewers hit 12 home runs in this series. Pittsburgh hit 3. Ulys Chastain was terrible once again for the Brewers, though. You have to wonder how long they can keep running him out there. Maybe a DL stint is in order, especially with Jimmy Nelson rejoining the rotation here this week. But Zach Davies, another good start for him on Sunday against Jordan Lyles. It's amazing what he's been able to do here, staving off regression. But you know, for this Pittsburgh team, the pitching staff has been terrible this year. They're very, very fortunate to be around 500 right now. 18 runs allowed by their starters in the 4 games in this series. The bullpen's had all sorts of problems as well. I don't know how long the Pirates can keep hanging on. I'm very worried about my season win total bet on them. There's a chance I buy out of it at the All-Star break because I don't see a team that's really improving much offensively. I see an organization that's very dead set in its ways. I think they may need to move on from Neil Huntington here. It's a tough spot for them right now where They're just kind of hanging on. And I don't know how long they can do that. But the Brewers here playing some gorilla ball in a park that's not really known for power. It was a pretty good look offensively for the Brewers here. And, you know, Keston Hiura's hitting. They're getting contributions from everywhere. Christian Yelich seems to be okay now. I think the Brewers are going to sustain this pace and really keep playing very well here over the next little while. The Astros went out to Oakland and swept the A's. And, you know, kind of scary, the dimension that they added in Sunday's game with Miles Straw. Miles Straw got a little bit of a cup of coffee last year. Now it seems like he may play a little bit more here this season. Three stolen bases, three hits, a walk. He's got high walk rates in the minor leagues. He gets on base. Just another dimension of danger for opposing pitchers here in this Astros lineup. They're the best team in baseball to me. You know, the Twins are very, very good. The Dodgers are very good. The Astros are the best team in baseball. And now they're adding another guy that could be a game changer for them in this lineup. It's amazing what they've been able to do here from a player development standpoint over the last several years. Now, the A's in this series, all seven of their runs via the home run. They had a two-run homer on Friday, solo shot Saturday, four solo home runs on Sunday, 0 for 17 with runners in scoring position. And this can be a problem for Oakland. You know, last year, this was a problem early in the season. They started having some more batted ball success, stuff like that. But this can happen to them where they get very home run dependent. We saw it here in this series against the Astros. We'll see how it looks for them in their next series coming up against the Angels. But the Angels do allow a lot more home runs than the Astros do, so it may not be that bad of a thing for them. Finally, one more series to take a look at here. The Indians lose 3 of 4 to the White Sox. This is a train wreck. This is bad. You know, Carlos Carrasco got knocked around once again. Shoddy command. The Indians didn't hit Manny Benuelos, didn't hit Dylan Covey, didn't hit Lucas Giolito. Trevor Bauer was better in this series, but the Indians made 4 errors. It seems like Terry Francona's given up. You know, he's making a bunch of bullshit cliches in his interviews. You know, they're talking about chemistry and attitude and all this stuff. You know what? First of all, there's not enough talent on the team. Second of all, the talent that is there is not performing up to its capabilities. We're talking about 3 really bad months from Jose Ramirez in a row now. And you have to wonder if we kind of saw him peak. I know the exit velocity metrics are there, but, you know, he's completely lost his swing plane. It's a disaster for him right now. And there's been some talk that maybe this is an anti-ownership sentiment that's coming through here with the Indians. You know, and there have been some different things. There's been some talk of Carlos Carrasco not throwing the max intent. Maybe some injuries have popped up there again. This is a debacle. This is a shit show, to be completely blatant and honest about it. You know, Lucas Giolito really dominated them a few weeks back. And it was kind of the catalyst for this Lucas Giolito run that he's on right now. And Giolito talked after the game about, I just threw fastball changeup, and they never adjusted to it. And he basically told them the blueprint for this game. And he threw 7 shutout innings, had 18 swings and misses. The Indians made no adjustments. Their hitting coach was quoted at The Athletic as saying he hasn't changed anything in 8 years. This is a mess. This is an organizational mess from top down. And the Indians have kind of been talking, you know, there's been some, hey, are you guys worried? Are you guys, you know, kind of squeezing the bats a little too tight, this and that? And there's been some talk, you know, Jason Kipnis is kind of at the forefront saying, well, no, we've only played the Twins 3 times. Well, we can make up our ground there. Well, they get the Twins Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And if the Twins dominate them in this series, which is entirely possible, this may be a last stand moment for this season for the Indians. Because Clevinger and Kluber are still out. The lineup's a mess. The outfield is a mess. And ownership sent this message, I guess I'll call it, that they weren't going to reinvest in the team. They cut payroll in the offseason. Trevor Bauer is going to be traded. Everybody knows Francisco Lindor is not signing with them. You know, they let Michael Brantley go, who was a very popular guy in the clubhouse. It's a decision I agree with, but you know, you see what he's doing for the Astros here, and it's a bad look all around. And it feels like that balloon has kind of popped a little bit. They got lazy. They got complacent off the 2016 World Series team. You know, they spent $20 million a year on Edwin Encarnacion, a designated hitter, in this market where you cannot afford to do that. And it was a lazy play. And the Dolans signed the check to pay him. And then 2 years later, they got out of it. And it's a bad state of affairs right now. And Francona signed this extension, but he's had the health problems. I don't think that there's a whole lot there in the tank for him. And I'm a firm believer in teams adopting the identities of their managers or coaches. You know, if you've got a fiery manager, you're a fiery player. If you've got a laid-back type of manager, things don't really get to you. If you've got a manager who seems to have thrown in the towel right now, as it appears that Terry Francona has, the team is following suit. If they get swept in this series by Minnesota, and it is very possible, and they fall 14 and a half games back, they are done. They are a fade team. They are done. So we'll see what happens here in this series. But watching those performances there against the White Sox, or at least catching up on them, a lot of bad habits, a lot of bad signs going forward for a White Sox team that really isn't playing all that well right now. I know from a record standpoint, they look okay. They're not really playing all that well here in the month of May, at least late in May, but real bad look there for the Indians. All right, so let's look at the last 30 days of offense here, which effectively eliminates cold weather. The Twins with a 375 wOBA, Nelson Cruz off the injured list today. Rockies 367, so they've gotten going. Red Sox have definitely gotten going as well. 360 weighted on base average over the last 30 days. Been talking about their offense, been waiting for them to go on a run. The offense has gotten better, but the pitching has not. We'll see if that gets a little bit better here as we go forward. Astros and Dodgers both at 358, two of the best teams in baseball. The bottom teams here, the Tigers 279, Blue Jays 280, Marlins 281, White Sox 289. Again, like I said, the White Sox have not been hitting all that well, but still wind up taking three or four from the Indians. Giants, 298. You know, the Phillies here, only a 300 weighted on base average over the last 30 days. They started out pretty good in April. They've fallen off the pace here a little bit of late offensively. The Braves at 305, Cardinals 307, Mariners 311. So some of the hot starters have definitely fallen off a little bit. We'll get back to the Phillies here in a second. Over the last 30 days here, as far as pitching staffs go, the biggest ERA to FIP gaps, Nationals, 0.76 runs. Their ERA, 0.76 runs higher than their FIP. Pirates, 0.59. Royals, 0.57. Mets, 0.43. Red Sox, 0.03 or 0.36. Mets, Red Sox, two teams still on my radar I still think could get hot. The Phillies, as I just mentioned, haven't been hitting. And over the last 30 days, a gap of 0.6 runs between their ERA and FIP on the negative side. So the ERA, 0.6 runs lower than the FIP, would suggest regression. They're not hitting right now. The Phillies are a regression candidate here in the near future. Astros, 7 runs better in the ERA department than the FIP department. Cardinals and Yankees, 0.33. Braves, 0.31. So for the Braves here, possibly a regression candidate as well, where their offense has fallen off the pace a little bit, and their pitching staff could follow suit here as well. So Pythagorean win-loss outliers, as we update those, the Pirates are +5, so their record is 5 games better than it should be based on Pythagorean win-loss, which is a standings metric derived from run differential. They've been outscored by 1.2 runs per game so far this season here, so you can see why they're kind of an overachiever thus far. Padres, Tigers, and White Sox all +4, the Pythagorean win-loss department. The Padres 14-6 in one-run games. Tigers have been outscored by 1.7 runs per game. So they've been bad. They've been really bad. And offensively, they've been terrible. So they're probably a fade team. We did kind of see that with the Braves and Tigers series. The Reds, -6 games in Pythagorean win-loss. So they should be 6 games better than they are. They should be an above 500 team based on Pythagorean win-loss. They've only allowed 3.8 runs per game. Their pitching staff has been exceptional so far this season. Royals -5. They're 4-12 in one-run games, so that explains that. Diamondbacks -4. 26 of their 60 games have been one-run games. They're 10-16 in those one-run affairs. So, you know, they're a team that just hasn't had a lot of luck in close games, which is why they're minus four from Pythagorean win-loss standpoint. Now, base runs. This is over at Fangraphs. This is a standings metric using run differential, again, based on context-neutral outcomes. So just all the outcomes, not accounting for who's on base and who's not. The Phillies are plus six from a base runs record standpoint. Once again, a regression candidate there. Yankees plus four, White Sox plus four. The Royals minus seven. So they should be seven games better than they are using base runs as your guideline there. Rays, Nationals, Diamondbacks, and Reds all minus four. A lot of bullpen blowups for the Nationals. Reds not scoring a lot of runs. Diamondbacks that poor record in one-run games. So you know, some outliers there. But again, a lot of times as we get deeper into the season here, those Pythagorean win-loss and those base runs outliers can dictate some of the line moves that we see out there in the marketplace as well. The Twins have played 39 games against teams with a losing record. They get another one here with the Indians on Tuesday. Red Sox have played 38, Yankees 36. The White Sox have only played 17 games against teams 500 or better, so they're a little bit of a regression candidate to me. Texas only played 18 games against teams 500 or better, and the Indians have played 17, and they're still bad. So that speaks to the train wreck that we're looking at there. All right, so you look down the lines, recap some line moves that we saw from over the weekend here. Friday, you know, it was interesting to not see a line move here between the Brewers and the Pirates. That was Ulys Chacin on the road as a $1.30 favorite with Chris Archer going for Pittsburgh. And Archer's been a guy that has taken on money a lot in his career with his ERA and xFIP discrepancies. Didn't take that money here. So that's an indication to me of how much Chris Archer's stock has fallen in the eyes of the betting market. They do not trust him. I don't trust him either. But that was a very interesting non-line move in that game on Friday. Money came in against Patrick Corbin on Friday. It's been rare to see that. We were on Corbin. That was a loser for us with Tyler Mahle going for the Reds. Saw a fade of Andrew Cashner or Andrew Trashner, as he was referred to out there in the betting community. That one makes a lot of sense. Cashner is a big-time regression candidate. We'll see money come in against him in his next start as well. Mike Foltynewicz and the Braves took money against Spencer Turnbull and the Tigers. The Tigers did win that game, but that was a common theme over the weekend with the Braves taking on a lot of money against the Tigers. It was the same thing on Saturday with Mike Soroka going up against Detroit. Daniel Norris for the Tigers. Norris has been bet against in a lot of his starts here so far this season. Saw money come in on Jack Flaherty and the Cardinals. That was against Jose Quintana and the Cubs on Saturday. Nick Margavicius took money against the Marlins and Jose Urena, the Padres left-hander, an ex-WOBA positive regression candidate, so he took money. Again, ex-WOBA drives a lot of market moves out there these days. Justin Verlander fade on Saturday. That was Oakland. Oakland did nothing against him, but again, Verlander, low BABIP, very high left-on-base percentage, a little bit of ex-WOBA regression in there as well, so he is in line for some tough times. We'll see if they actually happen here in the near future. Sunday, we saw money against Zach Davies, but he staved off regression once again. The Rays got flipped into a favorite. The Twins won that game comfortably. There will be some money against the Twins in the marketplace here in the short term. They're 40-19, best record in baseball. They're playing out of this world right now. When that happens, when you get a team that's just absolutely rolling, the market expects a regression to the mean. The market will come in against Minnesota, potentially here, even in this series against the Indians. I would not be surprised to see line moves on Cleveland here in this series. I will not do it. I don't know how much I'll be invested, but I think we will see some people expecting the Twins to come back to earth a little bit here, and that may be the moves that we see in the market in this series against the Indians. So money on Sunday against Lucas Giolito, but that didn't work. The Indians can't hit anybody with a changeup. If you throw a decent changeup, the Indians will not hit you. Giolito does, and that money that came in on the Indians did not work out. Saw a fade of the Rockies and Antonio Senzatella on Sunday, part of that because it was a day off for Trevor Story, who's very good offensively and defensively. So the Quant crowd moving that one around as their models were adjusted. Senzatella a bit of a fade guy there as well, even against the Toronto Blue Jays. Four games on Monday. That's it. One of them is a makeup game. Interesting spot. Angels and Cubs. Angels going from Seattle to Chicago, back home to host Oakland, We'll talk about that series in a minute. But an interesting situational spot there in that one. I just can't lay a big number on John Lester. Seeing some Aaron Nola money come in on the Phillies against the Padres. We know the Padres cannot hit righties, especially good ones. So that's my pick for tonight here. The Phillies and the Padres under the total. Money coming in on Aaron Nola does suggest that the market expects him to have a lot of success. I'm good with that. And as I just mentioned, the Phillies offense really hasn't been good over the last month. They have to draw walks. Doesn't walk a lot of guys. So give me the under tonight in that Phillies-Padres tilt. So let's look at four series here for the week ahead, beginning with the A's and Angels. Like I said, Angels go from Seattle to Chicago, back home to face the Oakland A's. Frankie Montas, Griffin Canning on Tuesday. I'll probably be on the A's tomorrow. We'll see what that price looks like. They should be a short road favorite with Montas on the mound, but I'm fading Griffin Canning. Second straight start against Oakland. That's not necessarily the reason. I think it does help the A's, but also a guy that, as I mentioned, has faced some very bad lineups this year. Gets a better one here in Oakland. So we'll see what that price looks like, but I'll probably be on the A's in that one. The situational spot helps a little bit as well. Daniel Mengen, Felix Pena on Wednesday. Expect an opener there for the Angels in front of Pena. And then Mike Fiers and Tyler Skaggs on Thursday. A lot of teams embracing this opener concept now. Real great for the operators out there or for bettors to get, you know, a decent price on the overnights. But keep an eye out for that. A lot of teams using the openers here. So a lot of times you're going to want to sit and wait and see what happens with some of those games. Twins-Indians series, as I mentioned, I feel like this is Cleveland's last stand. I know it's early June, but if they don't have good results here in this series, I think that they kind of cower a little bit. I think if they start looking at the trade deadline, they start looking at, you know, upsetting the status quo a little bit, I think this is kind of a last stand series for them. Devin Smeltzer, Shane Bieber in the first one on Tuesday night. Martin Perez, Carlos Carrasco Wednesday. Jose Barrios, Trevor Bauer on Thursday. The Indians get two lefties in this game, or in this series, I should say. They've not hit lefties well at all. And the Twins, meanwhile, get three guys allowing a lot of hard contact. Shane Bieber's a regression candidate. Carlos Carrasco's had no command all year. Trevor Bauer, I think, has allowed the second most barrels in baseball or something like that. He's allowed a ton of hard contact. Jose Barrios getting the start there for the Twins, who, you know, kind of stemming the trend a little bit of those home road splits. So we'll see what things look like there for this series. But I think the Indians kind of up against it here. I don't like any of these matchups for them, really. The Twins could have a field day against their pitchers. It's a tough spot. I really think it's a tough spot for the Indians. Phillies Padres. Here we got Aaron Nola, Eric Lauer tonight in a game that, as I mentioned, I like the under. Jerod Eichhoff, Chris Paddock tomorrow. Eichhoff, a guy with very well-defined platoon splits against right-handed batters. Gets a very right-handed heavy lineup here in this one. Maybe on the first five under in that game for tomorrow, or the full game under maybe even. And then Jake Arrieta, Joey Lucchesi on Wednesday. Again, I expect a very low-scoring series here between the Phillies and the Padres. How about the Marlins and the Brewers? Let's talk about this one. Marlins getting a little bit of love here on the program. Miami's staying hot, man. They're playing very well right now. Pablo Lopez, Chase Anderson on Tuesday. Sandy Alcantara, Jimmy Nelson on Wednesday. Caleb Smith, Brandon Woodruff. Real good getaway day game there on Thursday. Lopez, a positive regression candidate, but facing a very tough Milwaukee lineup. Alcantara is a really interesting guy because he induces a lot of weak contact, but he's had very little success with it so far this year. Kind of cut from the Brewers mold in that regard. Jimmy Nelson, first major league start since September 8th, 2017. That's a really interesting spot there for him. So we'll see if the Brewers' bats stay hot. We'll see if the Marlins can keep contending here. But, maybe a first five under or full game under on Thursday in that Smith-Woodruff matchup. Some interesting things to follow for Tuesday and Wednesday's games as well. Belmont podcast coming up Wednesday. Bettors Box Thursday. Back to UFC this week as well with a big card coming up this weekend in Las Vegas. So that's your outlook for the rest of the week here on Bang the Book Radio. But that'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And remember that you'll never strike out when you're in the bettor's box.